Good afternoon, and thank you for sticking with the pace of all these concurrents. For this session, we have Andrew Linfoot. Andrew recently joined Munich Re's Asia-Pacific team based in Singapore. He's responsible for the implementation of non-traditional reinsurance solutions in Southeast Asia, Australia, and the Middle East. He's worked with other life reinsurers in Asia since 1996 and in a variety of technical, business development, and leadership roles. Prior to his life reinsurance career, Andrew spent several years in superannuation consulting in Australia. A fellow of the Actuaries Institute since 1995, Andrew was actively involved in industry activities and is a past president of the Singapore Actuarial Society. Andrew currently sits on the academic board of the Singapore College of Insurance and is the Singapore ambassador for the Institute of Actuaries of Australia. Andrew is a frequent speaker at conferences in the region on topics of capital, risk management, and is a keen reader, golfer, musician, cyclist, and builder. So he's fitted us in that fairly busy schedule, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing what he's got to say about Asia, because it's a very interesting and dynamic community. Over to you, Andrew.
Thanks, John. Thanks, everyone, for coming along. One of the great advantages of speaking to an English-speaking audience, obviously, is that I don't need a translator. Obviously, when we have a sequential translation, it doubles the amount of time one needs, and you don't get very good audience feedback. But perhaps more importantly is that there is a cultural reference, a more similar cultural reference point that we share. So I've got a better understanding of what you're going to understand of what I say. This was illustrated quite clearly by a talk that happened in Asia. An American gentleman was using a sequential translation. He told a joke, a somewhat convoluted joke, took a while. The translator gave the translation, and then everyone laughed, and that was all good. But at the end of the talk, he asked the translator, "How did you manage to compress my story into a far, far shorter length of time than it took me to tell it?" And the translator said, "Well, I'm very sorry. I didn't actually understand your joke. So I just said to everyone, the American has made a joke. Would you all please laugh?" So the point there is that when you're in a different environment, you need to understand that environment well before you try and really engage with it. And clearly cultural reference points in areas like humor are quite challenging, quite difficult. And I think the same can be said for business as well. So really one of the objectives of my talk today is to try and give a bit of that description of the environment to tell you about what's happening in Asia and help you understand some of the why things that are going on. The other thing I would say is that Asia is really roaring along. Australia seems to maybe have hit a bit of a speed bump, or maybe it's a point of inflection, but Asia continues to power along. I had a holiday in Java. I went to the city of Yogyakarta. I wanted to visit the nearby Borobudur Temple, I think it's the oldest Hindu monument in the world. And I was really struck by the amount of economic activity that was going on in these back blocks of Java. Everywhere we looked, there were houses that were getting extensions, there were people opening shops, there were, you know, IT businesses starting up. And there everywhere there were signs for life insurers. You know, Prudential had signs out in the smallest village. And someone I know at one of the large multinationals told me that their business in Indonesia repatriates $300 million a year of dividends to the parent in Indonesia. I mean, this is to me still very much an emerging economy. Asia has many different economies at many different stages of growth. So we'll take a quick look at some of those. But those anecdotes really capture for me what's happening in Asia, and that's what I wanted to share with you. It doesn't look like...
Use the mouse on the table itself. Yeah, that should move the mouse, yeah.
Okay, maybe if I click on my name. Yep. Oh, there we go. Yep. Hey.
Sorry.
That's all right. So I'm going to cover this in four key areas. I've talked about the objective. So what are some of the trends that's going on. What does this mean for the sector and the product and the channel within that? I'm going to try and include the general insurance market as well, not just, this isn't just a life insurance issue, and it may be even be broader than that. But I think when you get down to product and channel, it's going to be more about life insurance, which I'm familiar with. And I'll talk about the implications for us as a profession. I'm happy to take any questions along the way, if you'd prefer to do that. I know how hard it is to hang on to a question until we get to the end. But I also want to do a quick time check and make sure I get enough time. We're 3:40, is that right, to finish? All right. Challenge for the chairman already.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first few I'll go through a bit quicker. This slide says that So GDP for Asia on the left, we've broken it down into mature Asia-Pac and emerging Asia. Mature Asia is countries like Australia, Hong Kong, Japan, Singapore, Korea, Taiwan, and some of the smaller ones. The emerging economies is chiefly made up of China and India. They're the big ones. Then you get into Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Thailand, those kind of countries, and a whole bunch of the Stans as well. So on the left, we see that while emerging Asia is a relatively big proportion already of global GDP, the chart on the right shows its proportion of the world population. So 17% of GDP is coming from Asia, but more than 50% of the world's population lives there. So that says there's going to be lots of growth in the future. Within those countries of Asia-Pac, it breaks down like this. You can see China and Japan are the big heavyweights. And clearly, they're quite different economies, and one's heading in one direction at a great rate of knots, and the other one's China. Within, though, even the other mature markets, Japan, Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Korea, there are quite different themes as well, different drivers. Okay? But those are the big ones. Some growth paths, just so you can have a feeling for it in pictures and in numbers. This isn't really an actuarial paper, I guess. There's no formulae, but I've got a few numbers, and I've got lots of pictures. But historical growth, about 2% annual growth for GDP in the developed countries, the mature countries, and about 9% in the past 10 years for the emerging countries. We project that forward at about 7% for the emerging countries and still about 2% for the mature ones. So you can see that sort of light pink block in the middle, that's China. That's the share that China has. It's enormous and it's growing, continues to grow quickly. Japan there is the lighter blue piece at the bottom, which shows a lot more stable pattern. Okay, so that's just a bit talk, a quick overview of the economic pictures. I want to delve into a couple of the more specific themes, things that I've seen. So I've called this Japan's economic imbalances. Why is it an imbalance? Well, my thesis here is that when governments or regulators put in some controls, there are often unintended effects. And these next couple of slides talk about the effect in Japan of the very low or negative inflationary environment, however, that's trying to be fixed by a very loose monetary policy. So it's very common in Asia for these imbalances to exist in many different places, and this is just an example of one. This is the yield on 10-year JGBs, Japanese government bonds. So back in the 90s, quite high, 6 to 8%. In the more recent times, it's been under 2%, and this year hasn't even got up to 1%. I think it actually touched 0.3% in April, 0.3% per annum for a 10-year bond. How do you make money with that? This morning it's recovered a little bit, so we're back up to 0.8. So it might be, there's actually a perverse kind of effect. The Japanese fiscal stimulus that we're seeing is, on the one hand, pushing down yields because they're buying lots of bonds, the central bank's buying lots of bonds. But on the other hand, it's letting yields rise because the end effect of this whole stimulus has been to, you know, refloat the economy. So while they continue to buy, yields are starting to edge back up again, which is going to present a whole set of other problems, which will be quite interesting. This shows a little bit the effect on both currency and the stock price of this wash of new money. It also ties in with the election of the LDP, the party that's ruled Japan for most of the post-war history. The blue line there is the Nikkei index, and the new government came in December 2012. So about there. Now they're well known for having a very expansionary outlook and policy. So immediately stocks took off. Now the purple line is the exchange rate, but it's with respect to US dollars. So it's the amount of yen that a US dollar will buy. So the increase represents a weakening of the yen. So it's really followed path the same way. The other effects we can see were in March when Prime Minister Abe announced his pick for the governor of the Bank of Japan. So Kuroda-san was well known as I can't remember if it is a hawk or a dove, one or the other, having a very strong predilection for pushing the markets by buying lots more bonds. So immediately that uptick you can see there, and then in April after his first board meeting, and announced that they were going to double the money supply in Japan and start buying a lot more bonds, this happened. So it's just quite interesting that we can see all of that reflected very much in the financial markets. So as actuaries, as business managers, how do we cope with this? We're going to spend our time observing the politics and trying to predict what's going to happen so that we can, if not trade against it, at least protect our portfolios. I don't know, that sounds like a really tough gig. I'm glad I'm working a reinsurer and we don't worry too much about asset risk. So a question here is this sustainable? Now, certain elements in the financial markets have been betting against this for many, many years. It's actually known as the widowmaker trade. And that's obviously shorting these bonds in anticipation that the government can't just keep buying them. One financial journalist noted that in 96, yields were at 3%. People were shorting them. In 2002, yields were down to 2%. People kept shorting them. In 2011, they were down to 1%. And people kept shorting them. So I think you get the picture, right? You can see why it's a widow maker. If you keep shorting that trade and it keeps going down, you may not want to stick around. That's a bit morbid. Well, so at 0.5%, will it keep going down? I don't know. And you can see one of the effects of this is that the government debt in Japan is at massive levels. 245% is the forecast for next year. I think Australia's in there at the... Oops, no, not in there. It's in there. Australia is that bottom line down there at 27%, and obviously lots of other Asian economies are managing their countries' finances more conservatively. Can Japan keep going with such a high level of debt? Well, initially you would think, well, clearly not. This is higher than I think Greece was. However, majority of this, more than 90% of this debt is domestically held. So it doesn't quite have the same issues as, say, as a Greece or any member of the EU. The currency will devalue, and as we're seeing, you saw on that earlier chart. Now, the domestic holders of debt don't really care if the currency devalues because their assets and presumably their liabilities are also in yen, so they're hedged. However, there must be an inflationary effect on them. because the government's policy of achieving a 2% level of inflation over the short to medium term will clearly have a big impact on real yields, where growth is currently negative and where yields are still very, very low. So I don't know what to do with all that. Can Japan keep financing its debt? Obviously, this has a big impact on their budget. So there seem to be a whole lot of forces building up in that market. If I was doing business there, these would be a whole lot of issues that I'd be having to worry about. Maybe someone will share with us in question time how they deal with them. But Japan's not the only place with very, very low interest rates. Singapore also has low rates. And a number of other Asian countries that are coded. All of this stuff's in the paper, which hopefully at the end you'll be so intrigued you want to go and read it all. So most of the countries have less than 4%. And that's obviously a big challenge for life insurers to manage, to live with and prosper with. So what are the things they've done in order to cope with that? Well, what I've seen is there's a lot more growth in unit-linked products, and there are a lot of very, very high product charges that are levied, outrageously high, I would say, in many Asian countries. So I think they're very poor value products. But anyway, this is supporting the life insurers in many countries. They're earning lots of money off that. There's also been growth in protection products, more innovation. It's a very, very innovative market for protection. As a reinsurer, it's very hard to deal with because we'll see a portfolio of risks and we need a pricing basis for 20 different things when we do one quote and we're given 2 weeks to do it. That's a challenge for us to manage. Some companies are taking on more market risk. Now, it's not necessarily a good thing, but if they can't earn in bonds, then maybe they can go earn in equities or property or overseas assets. We've seen some regulators have loosened the restrictions that they previously had on the amount of assets a life insurer could hold in foreign currency denominated assets, but also in equity type investments. Right, so that's all the sort of financy, economic kind of things. I want to look at some of the demographic trends. We know very well about increased longevity in Australia, and many countries in Asia have the same effect, obviously contributing to the aging society. However, there's three other factors that one might also call tsunamis that affect those countries, and I look at China in particular, and this is really a quadruple whammy, which is making the aging situation in that country at least much, much, much worse than I think we're seeing. So I'm going to have a look at the three of those. I'm leaving out longevity because I think we know a lot about that. But yeah, net migration, gender imbalances, and fertility rates. So starting with fertility, I found a table here of showing the trends in fertility across a number of Asian countries. The notable ones are really the top four, not just the level at the current point in time, but the trends over time. So China is down to 1.6. It's not that much lower than Australia at 1.9. However, you can see the trajectory, the path of that of those numbers down from 2. Hong Kong, on the other hand, is already very low at 1. Korea and Japan there at 1.3. although they have been a bit lower for some time. The other one in there, Singapore, is also very low. So clearly this isn't enough to replace those populations, so that's going to affect those countries and that trajectory for China in particular. Factors that have led to that, well, in China, the one-child policy is an obvious one. However, that policy was introduced, I think, in 1979, well before this chart. So clearly it's not just that policy that's driving fertility down there. And even there's, I think, a lot of relaxation in that policy of recent years. Other factors in China are the rapid urbanization. Everyone moving into cities means you're living in smaller apartments, which are expensive, so you need dual incomes to pay for that. It's too small to have grandparents live with you, so your childcare carers are no longer available, therefore put off having children. And in fact, in Shanghai, it was recently reported that the fertility rate in that city is down to 0.7. Okay, so that's not a good picture. Net migration. Australia is quite high, quite positive, and I think we know about that. We've been encouraging migrants to Australia for many, many decades. Singapore is higher than I thought it was, higher than I realised. We'll say a bit more about that later. But China, you can see down there at minus 0.3. This is the number of migrants per 1,000 of population. So that represents quite an outflow, which is going to be presumably the young and the productive rather than the old and maybe infirm or ones who consume resources. The last factor is maybe a more insidious one, and that's the gender imbalance. As we're taught as young actuaries, there are 105 males born for every 205 births, but not so in Asia. In a number of countries in Asia, and China really stands out there at 121 males born. Sorry, I've got that wrong somehow. This is a ratio of males to females per 100 female births. India, similar situation, although not quite as extreme. Hong Kong, Korea. Singapore higher than I'd expected as well. I think the drivers here, obviously there's a big cultural factor about the want to have male heirs rather than female heirs. I'm not going to go into the moral and ethical side of that. But I think access to technology, cheap technology to be able to detect the sex of an unborn child clearly is driving that trend, or the execution of that. Right, so all those four together, what do they produce for China? Well, I've got some interesting population pictures here. We used to call them pyramids, but they're no longer all pyramids. So in the 50s, this is what China looked like, your traditional pyramid. In 2010, looks a bit more like a Christmas tree, perhaps. I'm not sure if there's a technical word for that. And the projection to 2050, well, you tell me what that looks like. That's kind of ironic, isn't it? So I think a column is the accepted description. But clearly that's a massive change in the structure of that society coming over a very fast time. So the result of that, here we've got a projected old age dependency ratio. So starting at 2011, this is the population aged 65 plus over the working population of 20 to 64. So you can see it's around 13% at present, and it'll peak at more than 80%. It's projected to peak at more than 80%, and even rising, I think it's at 2050, it's already hitting 60%. The inverse of this is perhaps even scarier. At the moment, there are 6.6 workers per retiree, okay? But within only 30 years' time, there'll only be two. Now, this is in a country where there's no social security, there's no retirement savings, there's no compulsory savings at all, there's no dole, there's no old age pension. There's none of that. It's all about family support. Now, when the family is no longer there, we end up with a big conundrum. And it's often referred to as the 4-2-1 problem. In a typical family, there are four grandparents who have between them two children, and between them they have one grandchild. So that grandchild, heaven help him when he's got to support this tree of six people who've invested in him or her, but as you can see, more him. The other interesting thing, I found another statistic. In 2012, for the first time, at least in recent history, China's labor force actually declined. Now, I grew up where China was the place where lots of people were making things really cheaply because there were so many people who'd work for relatively little. Well, there are fewer of them now this year than there were last year, and that trend is projected to continue for at least 30 more years. So clearly that manufacturing role, that demographic dividend, as I think it's often referred to, is going to move away from China to other countries. It already has Cambodia, Vietnam has for some time. Perhaps even Africa becomes the place where cheap labor is sought. The other interesting thing I learned, I think it was 2 years ago, in Japan there were more, what do we call them? I'm not quite sure what the politically correct term is, but nappies for old people outsold nappies for babies for the first time. That was quite a startling piece of evidence. So, enough about China. Another trend, another theme to look at. I mean, everyone talks about social media and social tools. This is really one of the new waves of our lifetime. And it's interesting how this has affected many different kinds of businesses. So don't worry too much about the chart. I could have just put any colored lines on there going up and could have told you it means something. This actually is the number of Facebook subscribers is the blue one, and then there's various other social media sites all going up. But, I mean, you know that already. What's the impact of this? It's much more interesting. Well, when I started thinking about it, I use a site called TripAdvisor. A lot of people, I think, probably use TripAdvisor when they want to go for a holiday. This is a site where customers exchange stories about their experience with an investment they've made for a few hundred dollars at least, or possibly, in a product that they can't see or touch or hold before they actually need to use it. They need to pay for it usually well in advance, often well in advance, but not always. And so it's quite an intangible product. It's a promise, really. Actually, that's a lot like insurance, isn't it? You know, we're selling a promise. You don't get to try out our service until you really need it, and then you really need it. So TripAdvisor is interesting that customers are now having the conversation among themselves. It's not that companies are communicating with customers so much as customers are going out and getting unfiltered information and experiences. So that surely has to be a concern for us. This has had a big impact in the business of government. So if you think about it, people blogging, you know, citizens blogging, complaining about what they see of their government of in their country, this is really just the same thing as TripAdvisor's customers sharing information on a website. So in China, I did say enough about China, but different topic. China is quite interesting because they still try and control that media, that form of media. Now, many countries in Asia still control the print media and the broadcast media, but have given up now that it's come to online media. Well, China still tries to control it. It's quite funny. There's a cat-and-mouse game. Whenever there's a new issue being discussed, the censors quickly get on it and block all the discussion. So then the people who want to talk about it have to come up with, you know, a code word for it. A very simple one, the Tiananmen Square incident in 1989, I think it was, June 4. You can't search 4th of June or June 4 or any combination like that on Chinese websites. They're all blocked. Slightly lightheartedly, the party chief in Chongqing last year was involved in a bit of a scandal. His name is Bo Xilai. And, of course, his name was blocked. But the Twitterati started referring to him as the tomato. Some of the audience will understand why that's funny. I don't really, but I read that it was a bit of a pun on one of the characters in his name. So he became known as the tomato. So all discussion about tomatoes got blocked. in China for a while. So it's a bit of a problem if you're an online vendor of tomatoes. But press censorship still exists, as I said. It still does exist in Singapore. But we can see that with the online, with the rise of online discussions, as well as some other factors, the ruling party has started to lose its grip. In the last general election, its primary vote was down to 60%. It had been as high, I think, as 80% when I first moved to Singapore. So it's coming down very quickly. Some of this is attributed to online discussion, the ability for citizens to share their grievances. And we also saw, there was a population white paper in Singapore led to its largest ever protest. Now, 5,000 people protested at a population white paper. How cool is that? It was organized on Facebook. I mean, the issue was they didn't like the idea that the population was going to grow by 25% over the next few years, a place which is, by some measures, the most densely populated country in the world. So I can understand why that caused a bit of concern. But, you know, great that people had the ability to get together and discuss this.
Andrew, we're down just under 15 minutes.
Thank you. Excellent. Malaysia had an election a couple of weeks ago, and the incumbent Prime Minister, who was re-elected, is he shaking head, not happy about that? He made headlines when he referred to this as Malaysia's first social media election. And clearly he was referring to the ability for people to debate policy online now. So that's made it accessible to a whole lot more young people. Now, I think the outcome was that the ruling party lost a few more seats than they had, and the opposition increased their share of the House. However, I think they did lose a couple of states that they previously held. That's a good point. As we've seen in some other countries, you can win the popular vote but lose the election. If you look at this Facebook page, the last time there was a Malaysian election 5 years ago, there were trivial numbers of people who were online. So that's a real change. So the business of renting out hotel rooms, the business of government, and surely the business of insurance has got to change. It's going to be affected by this theme. I was looking for a picture to talk to about regulatory stuff, regulatory themes. This was the only one I could think of. Talk's got nothing to do with Solvency II, so don't worry if you can't read it. There are a couple of regulatory themes that are being felt. The IAIS is the International Association of Insurance Supervisors. It was formed in 2004, and recently they've managed to publish a set of guiding principles, 30-something guiding principles, which apply to all of their members, some 200 insurance regulatory groups across the world. And I'm seeing this in Singapore now. There's a big push to align local regulations with these principles. We're also seeing the IMF has it's called the Financial Sector Assessment Program. A bunch of government types going around auditing regulators. That's an interesting thought, interesting idea. And Japan, Australia, and Malaysia have already had their first audits done, I think, in the last year. Singapore's is underway at the moment. But the interesting thing is that this group actually publishes their report. You can go online and find them and find out how closely these countries' regulators are adhering to the principles that they've all signed up to in this forum. Now, to experienced, you know, international people from developed markets, this may not be such a big thing. But for emerging economies and developing countries and many Asian regulators who still follow a rules-based system rather than a principles-based system, this is a huge change. This is a big threat to them, but it'll also mean that there'll be massive regulatory change in all of these countries. And I think the number of consultation papers in Singapore last year was just horrendous. It slowed us all down. We all had to stop doing our day job and read up hundreds and thousands of pages of notes and give responses and argue. It's very tedious. There is a bit of a shift towards a principles-based system in many places, although I think it's quite gradual. There's a lot more focus on market conduct and protecting insurance customers. Some of that is well, it's all well-intentioned. Some of it's well-executed, but a lot of it's not. One thing that we noticed in Singapore was that when there was a commission cap used in the past, the commissions all went up to the cap. When the cap was taken away, competitive forces pushed them back down again. So it's a really, really interesting counterintuitive result of trying over-regulating. Right, that's regulators. So geopolitics is an interesting one. There's lots of conflict going on. Most of it's all fairly benign. I read the new guy, the young kid in North Korea, launched 5 missiles in the last couple of days. That's not good news, surely. On the one hand, although maybe on the other hand it is, maybe some of his supporters will finally crack the whip on him and get him to pull his head in. This map shows China's territorial ambitions in the South China Sea. Just because it's the South China Sea doesn't make it mean it belongs to China. This red line, all the way down here to Malaysia and across to the Philippines, represents China's current territorial claims. The various blue lines in there show different islands and competing claims of the other countries nearby. Now, the U.S. has waded into this because they want the right to of free passage for all of the trade that goes through that very busy shipping area. And these debates go on endlessly, and there's no sign of resolution. There are many other bilateral disputes, Korea and Japan and China, they're all going on. And the whole Taiwan issue, Taiwan, is it part of China or not? I'm not going to give you an answer. I'm not going to try and give you an answer. But the position that it's left right now, I would call it strategically ambiguous. What does that mean? Well, that means let's not push it. Let's just let it get on as it is. We'll call it Taipei, Chinese Taipei, or some other name, and we'll let it have an observer status in different international organs. But the mainland still thinks of it as a renegade province, as we keep getting told. The local population, they seem to grow to like this independence. So my fear is that neither will back away, and the current position will become more and more entrenched. And who knows where that's going to lead? We might end up with just a very, very long-term problem. Right, so those are all the trends. In 3 key areas, economic trends tell us Asia is big and it's growing. The demographic trends tell us that Asia is big and it's aging. But it also tells us that the middle class is growing at a much, much higher level. I found a quote from an analyst from Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, recently, who said that by 2030, Asia will contain 66% of the world's middle class, compared to 28% in 2008. That's quite important for us, because that typically is our customer base. Now, our customer base is growing massively in Asia. Social trends we've talked about as well. Customers are getting better informed, more access to information, there's more transparency, and regulators are getting more vigilant. So all of that means we need to be more professional. So my conclusion, that's not the conclusion for the whole talk. I've got 5 minutes left, so I go, blah. Right, that's my conclusion. So we'll look at some of the other evidence. It was only a midterm thing. So this is market share, projected share of new business market share growth, of new market growth, I think over the next 10 years. Nearly half of that comes from Asia in global insurance, non-life and life insurance premium growth. The chart at the bottom breaks it down among the mature countries. Japan is a big part. And then this is a similar chart, but breaking down the emerging market countries where China and India dominate. This tells us that, oops, all right. That told us that of the top 5 life insurance markets in 2020, 3 of them will be in Asia, and 3 of the top 6 in the non-life side as well. So Asia Pac is going to be very important to your business or our business. Right, That just presents the growth chart in another picture. This tells us that, oh, I was trying to make quite a subtle point here. If we look at the PNC penetration in the top left, we can see that there's still some room to grow in some of the smaller mature economies and for the other immature countries. I've not even shown them there because they're just tiny. And the reason I've shown this is that because when we look at the life penetration, Asia looks like it's already very, very high. You can see in the bottom left. You probably can't because I'm standing in front of it. But trust me, it looks very high. And the point I want to make here is that this includes the savings industry. There doesn't seem to be a very big set of investments providers, asset fund managers, in the Asian countries. So they tend to go through the life insurers. So this doesn't represent protection business. This represents savings. So it's very hard to be very careful when you look at penetration figures for Asian countries. Right, so some more of the more interesting stuff, perhaps. Impact on product. There's going to be a lot more comparison shopping, a lot of awareness and disclosure. Regulators are going to come down a lot harder on us. In Japan in 2008, the FSA ruled that the company's obligation to pay every single benefit that a claimant was entitled to, even if they didn't claim for every single benefit. And just think about that. If you get a claim for, let's say you put in your health insurance claim, and there's several different categories of things you could claim for, if you forget to claim for one of them, maybe the daily allowance, it's in Japan now, it's the company's responsibility to figure that out and pay it to you. And in 2005, the FSA figured out that there were 178,000 claims that had to be redone, that hadn't been done properly. 20 firms got improvement orders, and one was suspended for a while. I'm getting close. Channel agency still dominates. Bank assurance is growing. Mis-selling risks are very high. There were a couple of cases in Singapore I would have liked to share with you. One is notable, a company that whose agents had encouraged customers to tie their unit-linked products to a Lehman Brothers mini bond. They lost an awful lot of money. So the insurer, led by a couple of actuaries, I would note, decided, apparently of its own will, to redeem all of those bonds at face value. It cost them more than $250 million, but that was a great move. So those are the issues that we're going to have to face in terms of market conduct. So, last slide, implications for actuaries. Well, the actuarial profession in Asia is growing massively. I found out that in Singapore, the Singapore Actuarial Society grew its qualified members by 500% in the last 12 years. 500% growth. It's phenomenal. Some of the reasons for that, there's better statutory recognition over that period. There's a lot more requirements on actuaries. There's a lot more requirements on insurance businesses, and actuaries are very, very well placed to meet those. We're also branching out into much broader roles, head of marketing, head of business development, CFO, CRO, general managers. And in fact, 7 of the top 10 life insurers in Singapore have an actuary at the helm, in the CEO or MD role. 7 out of 10. I think there's none in Australia, from what I could tell. Right, and I think it's going to still grow for the future, so there's a lot of jobs there. 10 more to be for experienced people rather than new graduates, I have to say. But for people who want to try something new and something different, I don't understand all those themes, but there's definitely opportunities. And with that, I'll sit down. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Is this working okay? Thanks very much, Andrew. That was very interesting. If anybody has any questions from the floor, please use the microphone and state who you are before you ask a question. Anybody there? I'll ask a question myself at the moment, if that's okay. Andrew, if language, you mentioned the translator not being able to handle your joke earlier on. If, you know, Is speaking one of the dominant Asian languages a prerequisite in every sort of middle to senior management role, do you think?
No, I'd say certainly not. There are many jobs in regional teams, in senior roles in business where there's an understanding that not everyone's going to speak the local tongue. Even in countries like Thailand, there are many foreign executives working without language skills. Of course, it would be helpful. I love that my kids are learning Chinese. They don't love learning Chinese. But I try and encourage them to keep it up. I remember as my father encouraged me in the 80s and I failed to listen to him. So yes, it's good to have, but it's certainly not a necessity.
Any other questions coming from the floor? That was...
I think everyone wants afternoon tea already. Oh, got one?
Brett Walford, there's some emerging massive imbalances that are going to occur in parts of Asia. I mean, we already know when the population gets top-heavy, as it has in Japan, decline, what happens there. Surely the problem's going to be far, far worse in China.
Absolutely.
If you were Chinese and you were educated like you are and you lived in Beijing, what would you do?
Well, that's a really good question, Brent. That's like an exam question.
Okay.
Well, I'd probably be doing what everyone else is doing in terms of studying hard, getting a qualification, trying to have one child, and trying to hope let them get a great education and hope that, you know, they might be nice to me in my old age. You know, I wiped their butt when they were young. Maybe they'll do me the same favour when I'm old and need it. But maybe as a demographer or as an insurance practitioner, what would I do? Well, As a businessman, I've got to look forward at those trends and see, well, where does my business need to go to initially survive that trend, but also to perhaps capitalize on it, profit from it? What kind of businesses are going to be in demand in the future? Will there be lots of nursing homes to look after these childless invalids? I don't know. Maybe we need to buy building stocks or buy nursing homes, starting building nursing home countries. I don't know. I don't know enough about China to understand or to forecast that. But what I do know is anyone there has to be thinking about it. And any business that wants to be an Asian insurance business has to have a view on that.
Is it one of the reasons why some Chinese people want their children to be educated in Pacific Australia or Canada or the United States? Because it gives them a whole lot of things to go on.
Certainly, I think that's a good observation. It's certainly an option for them. It also gives them a language, helps them differentiate against their peers. What's a very crowded employment space. While the workforce may still be declining, the knowledgeable workforce is growing, obviously. And there's intense competition, I think, for those jobs. So anyone that's able to communicate with foreign-speaking shareholders has a big advantage, I would guess.
I've got another question. Sorry.
We can talk.
I was asking questions. Isn't the solution the solution from the China-Taiwan conundrum simply economic integration? In other words, forget about the political bit.
The economies
are so...
But the face issue.
Yeah.
Yes, that's happening now.
Yes, that's right.
But there's always going to be this face issue. Who owns it?
Yeah. It won't matter in the end. They won't each other.
Possibly, but I think ultimately it'll come to a head. It may. It may just go on as it is.
Okay, well, we need to draw it to a close there, but I'd like you all to thank Andrew for his insights and the